A change at the top of the Securities and Exchange Commission. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update Podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is November 26th. Happy Cyber Monday, everybody. Along with the departure of SEC Chair Mary Shapiro, we'll try to put the long weekend's retail frenzy into perspective for you. And we'll talk about the fact that the fiscal cliff isn't the only big deadline looming at the end of this year. The world's countries are gathering in Doha today and staring at the coming climate cliff.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission is stepping down next month. It's not a surprise. Mary Shapiro was one of those widely expected to leave ahead of Barack Obama's second term. It's been a long 4 years for anybody overseeing financial regulation in Washington. Shapiro became the first woman SEC chair in early 2009. She's been central in not only pursuing those who contributed to the financial crisis, but crafting regulations to prevent the next one. Marketplace's David Gura is with me from our Washington Bureau to talk about her legacy. Hi, David.
Morning, Jeff.
So December 14th, I think, will be her last day. Why is Mary Shapiro leaving?
Well, I don't think we should read too much into this. President Obama, as you mentioned, is getting ready to start his second term. It's a time of transition here in Washington. Shapiro's been in this job for about 4 years now. And according to a statement the SEC just released, she just decided it was time to go.
So take us back through some of what she has been through since she took this job.
And it's been a lot. I talked to Jim Angel. He's a finance professor at Georgetown. And he said that Mary Shapiro saved the SEC. That's pretty high praise. But this was a job not many people would have wanted back then when she took it. And for taking it, Jim Angel told me, Mary Shapiro deserves, get this, a spot in the Bureaucrats Hall of Fame.
When Mary Shapiro arrived as chairman of the SEC, the agency was in the doghouse. They had flubbed Madoff. They had flubbed the financial crisis. Congress was looking at financial reform. The SEC was on the chopping block.
And Jim Angel said that Shapiro was this amazing hybrid, a bureaucrat who knew the system, knows how it worked, and yet someone who had a good sense of politics, who could work with Congress to gain their trust, to regain their trust. She'd work with them on rules and regulations. And as Jim Angel said, she made the case for increasing funding to the SEC at a time when demands on the agency, thanks to financial reform, thanks to Dodd-Frank, were getting bigger and bigger, Jeff.
And quickly, David, we already know that President Obama plans to nominate another woman to succeed her, Elise Walter. What can you tell us about her?
Yeah, so this isn't too much of a surprise either. She's currently an SEC commissioner, and traditionally the heads of these regulators, the heads of these agencies come from within. These are people who've had long careers there. I know that there was some hope for an outsider, someone who doesn't have a background in this bureaucracy. Walters was not that choice, Jeff, but anyhow, she knows the system well.
All right. Thanks very much. Marketplace's David Gura in Washington.
Thank you, Jeff.
And let's do the numbers. Well, the morning has started out on a negative note on Wall Street. The Dow at this hour is off about 0.2%, so not an inconsiderable amount. The S&P 500 is off about 0.6%, and the NASDAQ is down just a bit. The Dow at this hour sitting at 12,922. We Americans spent almost 13% more over the long holiday shopping weekend than we did last year, according to the National Retail Federation, and 6% more people dove into the Black Friday binge. All that matters to retailers and to the economy, of course, is how things shake out in the end. And to talk about that, we've got Julia Coronado, chief economist at BNP Paribas, with me many Mondays. Good to talk with you, Julia.
Good morning.
So I had the good fortune to find myself at the epicenter of things, or it felt like it, a Walmart in Iowa on Thursday night, and it was insane. But how much can we read into the long weekend frenzy?
Well, a lot of it is just increasing concentration. So as we saw last year, there was actually a 16% increase in Black Friday shopping last year. But overall, the holiday season was just, you know, moderate gains. This pulls forward shopping from other days and later weeks in the holiday shopping season. So a lot of it is just deal-centered concentration of shopping rather than an absolute increase in how much we're buying.
So people are being pulled toward these days, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, now Cyber Monday. Where does this end? Can we claim every day between now and Christmas as some sort of retail event?
Well, retailers will stop at nothing, and I think some of this is already getting more diffuse. The online deals start well before Cyber Monday, and Black Friday starts actually on Thanksgiving. So already these definitions are becoming a little bit less precise, and I think what it reflects is that consumers want deals. Consumers are still cash-strapped, and they're looking for a deal, and retailers are competing with each other to deliver that to them.
All right, Julia Coronado, Chief Economist at BNP Paribas, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Today, of course, is Cyber Monday. Can I say it a few more times? Cyber Monday, we're all going to say it plenty, I'm sure. Supposedly the busiest online shopping day of the year. But as Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports, even though it seems like we've only just coined this term and we're so quite in love with it, aren't we? The face of Cyber Monday is already changing.
Remember back in the olden days of 2005, before smartphones, iPads, or super-fast internet connections at home, millions of Americans returned from their Thanksgiving weekends to high-speed internet at work, got busy shopping, and the term Cyber Monday was born. Ah, how time flies. Mia Chernoff is with Chase Payment Tech, which tracks consumer spending.
Today, with phones, tablets, and broadband in the home, consumers don't have to rely on going to the office to do their shopping.
But just because we don't have to shop online at work today doesn't mean we won't. 129 million Americans plan to buy online today, up 6 million from last year. Sucharita Mulpuru, a retail analyst at the market research company Forrester, says Cyber Monday gets bigger every year.
And a lot of that is just because retailers seem to be offering more generous discounts, pushing bigger and bigger deals on these days.
And in case you hadn't had enough, get ready tomorrow for the newly coined Mobile Tuesday. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
And as I was poking around this morning online, a little bit of valuable data here for parents and curious data for other folks, maybe. A new study from the Center for Injury Research and Policy took on what might seem to be like one of the safest ways for kids to burn off steam, the bouncy house. After all, can you do any better, really, than a padded floor and padded walls? Well, yes. Yes, you can, apparently. 11,000 kids went straight from the bouncy house to the emergency room in 2010, mostly broken bones and sprains. The surge nicely tracks the rise in bouncy house use at carnivals and parties, which has skyrocketed in recent years. In the end, the bouncy house market may prove to have been something of a bubble.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Here in the U.S., we are obsessed with our fiscal cliff, and perhaps we should be, but the end of the year also brings a deadline the entire world is all but certain to miss. The Kyoto Protocol is the last major international agreement to limit greenhouse gas emissions, and it expires at the end of 2012 with no replacement. Under that shadow, the annual international talks to address climate change got underway this morning in Doha, Qatar. The BBC's environment correspondent Matt McGraw is covering the talks. Good to talk with you.
Yes, Jeff. Nice to talk to you, too.
In one of your recent pieces, you quote an official calling this a golden opportunity. For what, specifically? What's the agenda here?
What it is, I suppose, is an opportunity to try and put together a global deal on climate that will involve all the countries that have signed up to the Kyoto Protocol in the past, but other countries such as India and China and the United States as well.
Is that just optimistic talk, this golden opportunity stuff from somebody involved in putting this on, or do you think there's really a chance it could be different this time?
It could always be different, but I think what we've seen happen in the past is long, torturous sessions into the night, people haggling over small points, and eventually some small step forward being made. Having said that, there are some factors this year that make it more germane that a decision will be reached. The money that the government set aside in 2009 to help developing countries to adapt to climate change, that runs out at the end of this year. And also the Kyoto Protocol, the first commitment period of that runs out at the end of this year. But as I said, getting to those agreements could be very, very difficult indeed.
And we're always naturally getting new climate data. Has the latest data, in your estimation, relaxed or increased the urgency?
It kind of does both in some ways, if you like. We've had, I suppose, a slowdown in emissions in some countries due to the economic recession globally. The United States, for instance, has lowered its emissions back to levels last seen in the 1990s. On the other hand, you have the likes of India and China where the emissions are going up, increasing rapidly, particularly in China, and that is making the ability to tell those countries to rein in their emissions much more difficult. So, you know, it's very much a work in progress, a moving jigsaw, if you like, that's very difficult to get agreement on any one part at any one time.
Matt McGraw, environment correspondent for the BBC. Thank you.
My pleasure.
There are violent protests going on in Egypt again this morning as the country's president, Mohamed Morsi, meets with senior judges. They're trying to resolve tensions over Morsi's decision last week to expand his powers. But the stock market is not waiting around for a resolution. It has been dropping fast. Earlier today, my colleague Jeremy Hobson talked with the BBC's John Line in Cairo. Here's Jeremy.
So, John, first of all, just bring us the basics. What is Morsi trying to do exactly and why?
Well, he's issued an edict giving himself sweeping new powers, really saying he can't be challenged on anything. Now, he said he needs to do that to protect the revolution because the courts have been, as he would see it, sabotaging some of the work of his government and the transition to democracy. In particular, he's trying to protect the assembly that's writing a new constitution, and he's trying to push ahead with the prosecutions of former regime officials, people around former President Mubarak, who are accused of the killing of protesters. So he says he's doing it to protect the revolution, but his opponents say what he's doing and the way he's gone about it really mean he's just becoming a dictator, just like his predecessor.
Now, John, this has had a big impact on the stock market there in Egypt, where there's been a significant drop over the last several days. Why is this having such a big economic impact?
I think for two reasons. Firstly, the most obvious one, just the uncertainty, the way the country is in such a degree of turmoil once again, and a lot of conflict, internal conflict in the country. And we've seen now already one Muslim Brotherhood member killed defending one of their offices. But also because we're in the midst, of course, of the run-up to negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, which has already agreed in principle to a multi-billion dollar loan, which Egypt desperately needs. It's been agreed by the team, but it still needs to go to the IMF board of directors, which, for example, the United States has a big say on. And the United States, Washington, has already said it doesn't like what President Morsi has done. So in theory, this could be held over Egypt as they try and get their crucial IMF loan.
The BBC's John Line joining us from Cairo. Thanks, John.
My pleasure.
Detroit is on the verge of bankruptcy. And to be clear here, we're talking about the city itself, not the car makers, who are doing all right at the moment. Detroit has a deal with the state of Michigan that is supposed to help keep the city solvent. But it's become clear that's just not working. From Michigan Radio, here's Sarah Swick.
Detroit's latest cash crisis stems from a rather petty dispute. The state of Michigan helped the city borrow millions in bond money earlier this year, but the state is holding that money in escrow until Detroit meets certain conditions. One of them was that the Detroit City Council approve a contract with a particular law firm. They didn't do that.
The state is holding the cards at this point.
That's Detroit Mayor Dave Bing. He says the city could now run out of cash before the end of the year. Detroit has an agreement with the state of Michigan that's supposed to keep this type of crisis from popping up. The mayor's chief financial officer, Jack Martin, says Detroit will get through it one way or the other.
We're planning at this moment to implement additional cuts to ensure that the city doesn't run out of money.
As of now, Martin says the plan is to make city employees take unpaid furlough days. He insists there's one road the city absolutely won't go down.
Bankruptcy is not an option.
But as Detroit's money woes continue, the word bankruptcy is popping up more and more in the Motor City these days. In Detroit, I'm Sarah Swick for Marketplace.
Processed cheese food. When you put it like that, doesn't sound real tasty. But doggone it, we eat a lot of American cheese in this country. We buy hundreds of millions of pounds of it every year. Now, a health-conscious competitor wants in on that market share. Shannon Mullen has more.
Here's my question. Can you still call it American cheese if it's unprocessed and has only four ingredients, all of which you can pronounce? The country's largest co-op of organic farmers says yes. Wisconsin-based Organic Valley is out to reinvent our de facto national cheese. The company recently wrapped a two-month nationwide Cheese Revolution tour and gave away more than 15,000 grilled cheese sandwiches made with its new Organic American Singles. Audrey Cattell handled the company's marketing on the North Carolina leg.
I think it's important that people know about what's in American cheese, and especially when it says cheese food on the label. Ours just says cheese.
In the parking lot of a Whole Foods in Charlotte, Kim DeRhodes took the taste test.
Very good. It just doesn't taste as fake as the regular cheese.
Pasteurized processed cheese food does start out with real cheese, but it's melted and mixed with emulsifiers and preservatives. The final product can't be called cheese by law, and at some point it got a reputation of being unhealthy. Some in the industry say that's a bum rap. Kraft Foods, the country's best-selling brand of American cheese, declined to comment, so I turned to one of the cheese industry's top trade groups.
It's a dairy-based product, but it's, you know, it's the product that is not going to be called gourmet. It's not going to be called artisan.
John Umhafer is executive director of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association.
It's old line stuff, but it's a cheese that's been around for decades. It's got its purpose. It tastes great, but there's nothing unhealthy about it.
Plenty of consumers agree. The market research firm Symphony IRI says in the past year, sales of processed or imitation cheese slices topped $2 billion nationwide. John Umhafer says with a market share like that, he doesn't see organic alternatives winning a war on processed American cheese. But he adds, there's room in the industry for both. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
And just kind of wrapping things up as we wind down here, if global warming or the fiscal cliff or our love of processed foods don't get us, maybe the robots will. Fortunately, Cambridge University is on the case. The hallowed institution is launching the Center for the Study of Existential Risk. The focuses will include, along with climate change and nuclear war, the potential of the human race to be done in by artificial intelligence. It's serious stuff. The Daily Mail quotes one of the center's founders saying, "We need to do a better job understanding the risks of potentially catastrophic technologies." And finally, on a less Armageddon-like note, I guess, you might think the great ocean navigation records have all been claimed by this point, but in fact, there is at least one more, and a brave soul from the UK will step to the water's edge later this week, bend down, and launch his sturdy craft. The challenge? To become the first unmanned vessel to cross the Atlantic. The 30-pound sailboat, the Snoopy Sloop, will use solar power and a GPS system to find its way from Hampshire, England, to somewhere near Plymouth, Massachusetts. If all goes well, it'll take about 6 months. Three attempts by other folks have failed in recent years. So, Godspeed on your journey, Snoopy Sloop. That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.